Accession number 27344, Wheel 1.
Robert McCandless, Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Oh, 25th of September, 1924, in a very small village in Scotland called Cambus, which is 5 miles east of Stirling.
And what did your father do for a living?
Oh, he was a junior civil servant. He was what they call in Scotland a godger, customs and excise. And his job was to check the distilleries to make sure that the whisky that was made was actually put, first of all, into bond, and what was in bond was kept in bond and wasn't mysteriously disappearing. So that was his job. And by the time I started to really pay attention to what was going on, he was at this big distillery in Cambus, which in fact was the biggest grain distillery in Scotland. Why I say grain distillery is distinct from malt distilleries. And they used to produce an awful lot of the whisky which was blended with the malt to make the blends. And we lived in this small village of less than 250 inhabitants. And of course, very much a farming community. And by the time I was aware of what was going on, 7 or 8, we were getting into the Depression period, and in Scotland at that time, the Depression was really very, very hard on so many people, particularly farming communities, simply because there wasn't the money. We were rather protected from the worst of it just because my father was a civil servant. But I used to, when I was from 10 onwards, I suppose, I used to go to work in the farm in the summer holidays, and I used to thoroughly enjoy that. But the thing that was amazing when I look around me now is to remember the responsibility that we were given at the age of 11 and 12. I'd have 2 Clydesdale horses, that's like the big heavy footed ones, and although I didn't have to groom them, I had to help harness them and get them into the machinery that we were using at the time. And my particular machine that I can remember so well was a reaper and binder. So there was 2 horses and this machine. And the machine was a real Heath Robinson contraption of canvas belts and flailing arms and all sorts of stuff. But that was my machine, and I had to make sure it worked. And one of the terribly important things was that there were no ball bearings in it. So every union had to be lubricated very regularly. And if something got too hot and jammed, it was my fault. And the farmer wasn't slow to let you know. But anyway, I can remember working with these 2 horses so well. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I still go to the Shire horse places and see the big horses and really take myself back to the days of my youth. But that's what I was doing anyway as a youngster in my holidays. But again, looking around and seeing what the children do, I think it's very sad that they aren't allowed to do their own thing and to learn responsibility for their own actions. And if they get their knees scraped because they fall, they go and get some iodine on it and that's it, they go back and play. And, of course, the political correctness nowadays leaves me absolutely furious for the way everyone tries to protect children from being children. And I think that is terribly sad. I think they miss out on a lot of fun in life.
Did you have any kind of hobbies and things that you do as a child?
No. My hobby was being out in the fresh air. I had a bike, and my friend and I used to cycle everywhere, including cycling from home up into the Trossachs and playing in one of the lochs up in the Trossachs and cycling back home at night, 25 miles both ways.
What about the family home? What was that like?
Oh, it was a house which was belonging to the distillery where my father worked, and there was a row of seven terraced houses, and it was occupied all by customs excise officers and their families. And that was a lovely house. It was quite well provided for, and we had gas very early on, and in fact the distillery put in a very special gas arrangement whereby there was a switch at the door to switch on the gas in the centre of the ceiling. Now that was quite amazing in those days, but we felt we were really at the leading edge of technology. But it was great fun. I really enjoyed my childhood. And school, the primary school was in a village called Tullabuddy, which was, I suppose, a mile and a half from my home. And we used to walk there in the morning, walk back for lunch, and walk back to school after lunch, and walk home in the evening, or run. I seemed to do an awful lot of running as a youngster. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But that's what we used to do, and the local baths in a local town called Alloa were very popular with us. And we used to go as a gang, and one of the things was we used to go on a Sunday morning, and there might be 11 or 12 of us, all on bikes, going together, spread out right across the road. And of course there was no other traffic, we would just cycle 2.5 miles into the local town, then go swimming in the baths. But mainly it was out and about and doing things physical rather than things mental. Although I did have a Meccano set which I used to play with in the winter. But again, I was allowed to do more or less what I liked around the house with the Meccano set. And I used to build bridges across the stairs and all sorts of things. But I liked doing things all the time with my hands, and that was what made me happiest, I think. Although I did read a lot, I enjoyed reading.
And academically, how were things at school?
Oh, well, I seemed to get on quite well. I was one of the youngest in my class just because my birthday was that sort of time. And I got through my 11 plus and went to the local academy, and I enjoyed that thoroughly. The only thing I was disappointed about was when I came up to the O-level stage and I asked to do geography as one of my main subjects. And the headmaster said, no, you can't do geography, you'll have to carry on doing Latin. So I did Latin for 7 years. I never passed one exam, and I really hated it simply because I was forced to do it.
What about sport? Did you play any sport?
Yes, I was very keen on sport. At the primary school, we used to play football. I wasn't terribly good at football, but I liked running around. And then at the academy, we played rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer. I enjoyed rugby simply because I liked running and I was quite fast. And I used to play either three-quarter or half-back, sometimes full-back. But cricket in the summer, I was not very good. I wasn't a good bowler, and I wasn't a good batsman, and I wasn't a wicketkeeper. So I used to finish up on the boundary. And of course, like all children, when you're sort of out of the centre of things, you're not really paying full attention. The number of times that I didn't even notice that the ball came in my direction. So I wasn't very popular in the cricket team.
I was going to say, with cricket, you don't really associate cricket with Scotland much. Oh, rugby, no, and football, no. Definitely, but not cricket.
That's right, but the school didn't have any other summer sports, so that was what we played in order to get out and about. We had a two-hour period in the afternoon on a Wednesday, which was sports, so we knew we were going to play rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer. And we always had competitive games with other schools at the weekend. And that was always good fun. We weren't a particularly successful school, but we always enjoyed the games. Yes, I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed my childhood and school days. I sat the Scottish equivalent of the O-levels when I was 15 and the equivalent of the A-levels just before I became 17. And I seemed to excel more at maths and science. So my mother was keen, actually, that I should become a doctor. But in the summer of 1942, I was just coming up to 18 then, and I was thinking of whether I was going to go to university or not, and I had a long conversation with my father, and the opportunity came up for an apprenticeship in the local brewery. And he said, well, you might as well do that because you're going to be called up when you're 18 anyway, so it'll give you something sensible to do until you're called up. And at that time, I had been a member of various scout groups and Sea Scouts, but then at the start of the war, I transferred from the Sea Scouts to the Air Training Corps. And one of the advantages of being in the Air Training Corps was that we used to be taken to the local airfield to get air experience. And the local airfield, as far as we were concerned, was Donibristle, which is an airfield near the Forth Bridge, along near the South Dockyard. And the aircraft that were flying from there were Swordfish. So the first flight I had was in a Swordfish, in the back, you know, open cockpit in the back of the Swordfish. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So when I was coming up towards 18, if I was called up, I'd have gone into the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. That was our local regiment. And I decided I really didn't want to do that. So I volunteered for the Sleet Air Arm before I reached my 18th birthday. And, of course, my mother was a bit distraught about that. But anyway, just after my 18th birthday, I got a call up to join the Fleet Air Arm.
Had you had any interest in aviation prior to that first flight or being in the Air Training Corps?
No, not at all. There were many aircraft around, and the only aviation I had actually seen, I suppose, before going to Donibristle was when a Tiger Moth flew in and landed in one of the fields in the farm I worked on. And this was somebody who was coming, I've forgotten the lady's name, but she was quite a famous, Amy Johnston. She had landed to come and see one of the local gentry. And, of course, the local policeman was there trying to keep us away from the aeroplane and having quite a job. Because we were all running around and under the wings and all the rest of it. But that she came twice to see him. And that was the only time we ever saw an aircraft close up. We used to occasionally see them flying, but very, very seldom. Because at that time, we're talking about the early 1930s up to 1935, this was. There were very few aircraft around.
Did people follow the exploits of people like Amy Johnston?
Oh, yes. I think reading about her in the newspaper, well, that's one thing that I used to pay attention to. My father was quite interested in it as well, and if he saw something, he would pass it on to me to read. And I certainly enjoyed reading about it and thinking about it, because she really was quite famous in her own way.
Prior to your call-up, obviously, slightly later into the war, had you had any anticipation that war was coming in the late 1930s?
Well, I suppose my parents did, and it passed on from them. Because, of course, they had gone through the First World War, and my mother had lost some of her family in the First World War, and she was very wary about the whole situation. So it wasn't talked about much, but it was there in the background, and as far as I was concerned, I was still enjoying myself. But then the first, well, up to 1939, it didn't really impinge on my life personally. But it was there, and then we were in church on the day that war was declared, and the minister had provided a wireless down by the altar for us all to listen to the Prime Minister's speech. So that's where I heard it.
At that stage, obviously, you were quite young, relatively young.
Oh, yes.
Did you think that you would be involved?
I was looking forward to it. Yeah, I didn't know how or what, but I suppose we all had romantic ideas of what the war was going to be like, and I'm afraid my romantic ideas stayed with me into the Fleet Air.
So you were up to the point where you'd taken an apprenticeship with the brewery.
Yes.
What was that? What did that involve?
Oh, to begin with, I was put through all the various departments in the brewery just to get experience and to learn the language and see what it was all about. I started off in the office and then worked on various parts of the brewery and I'm just trying to think now. One of the jobs which I did do was in the maltings. You know, maltings is where the barley comes in to be made into malt. Malt is actually barley which has started to grow and then the growth is stopped by heating. And a grain of barley then has a very short length of stem growing up under the husk and little rootlets. And when it gets to the stage where the stem is about three quarters of the length of the grain inside it, the growth is stopped by heating. And according to the degree of heat and the length of time at heat, you get different colours of beer. Shorter the time, the lighter the colour of the beer. The longer the time, the higher the temperature, the darker the colour of the beer. So the grain used for stout or porter is very nearly burned. It's quite dark and very bitter tasting when you actually eat the grain. But the grain for lager or the bitters or light ales is really, it still looks like a grain of barley and it's quite juicy and sweet to eat. Now the reason that this is done is that when a grain starts to germinate, the starch of the grain starts to be converted to sugar, because grain is insoluble, sugar is soluble, and the sugar is what goes to the growing points to make the stem continue to grow out of the ground. So it's the change from starch to sugar is the malt, and that's when you start to use it to make beer or to make malt whiskey. Same process. So I used to work in the maltings. Now, in those days, there was very, very little machinery. And what they used to do was to get these bags and bags of grain, and they were spread out on a concrete floor. Now, the concrete floor could be, about half the size of a football pitch, getting on towards that sort of size. And it would be 3 inches deep. And that had been soaked first and then spread on the floor. And because it had been soaked and it was this deep, you started to get internal combustion taking place, so the temperature of the whole floor would start to rise. And if you just left it there, you could get combustion. So to avoid that and to control the temperature, it all had to be turned. And this was turned by hand. And there would be a gang of, say, 6 or 8 of us turning this whole floor by hand. Now, it was like a wooden shovel. It's called a skip. And you just get into a rhythm of chucking this over to the next part of the floor. And that would gradually build up from 3 or 4 inches here to 3 or 4 inches there. And the whole gang would just move down together. And we used to start quite early, 5:30-ish, to get on with this job. And then about 7:30, you would have turned maybe 2 floors. So they'd have a break for breakfast. So I used to cycle back for breakfast. Now, that was 2.5 miles back home. And, of course, young and doing a fairly energetic job, I used to eat an enormous breakfast, then cycle back and carry on doing more malting work. But it was all physical, entirely physical work, and I enjoyed it. But I didn't give a lot of thought what I was doing or why. And then after I had been round the various departments in the brewery, including the maltings, I went into the laboratory. And because I had done science A-levels, I was expected to be able to do work in the laboratory. But, of course, the main work was bottle washing. So I was washing all the glasses, beakers and everything else that had been used in the laboratory, and just gradually learning how to help there, doing very simple experiments and tests. But the brewery laboratory used to do quite a surprising number of tests, from the grain that was going to be used through the hops that were going to be used and into the actual coal that was being used to fire the boilers, because they used to want to know the calorific value of the coal. In the hops, they would want to know the percentage of essential oils, and this was the sort of work that was going on. And it was quite delicate laboratory work. But unfortunately, because it was not as physical as the rest of it, I didn't take as much interest as I should have done. But then I moved on from there into the actual brewing itself. And I enjoyed that more, because we used to actually, at that time, I don't know whether it's still the case to tell you the truth, all beer was brewed in batches. I mean, you would fill a vessel with 100 barrels of water, and from that 100 barrels you would put it through the process and you'd finish up with about 100 barrels of beer, approximately. And that batch would take, I don't know, shall we say, a full day to actually get the beer in the situation where it could start fermenting. And then it would ferment for 10 to 14 days. And at the end of it, that was ready to be either put in casks or bottles and sent out. So that every day you had a different series of brews. In our brewery, we actually made 14 different varieties of beer. And this was from lager, bitter, mild, stout. And we'd make them under a whole variety of different names. So that when they went into the bottle, they might go out marked Calder's or Arrol's or Newcastle Brown or whatever. And it was good fun. But again, it was fairly physical. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. And again, going round, I, as the youngest there, was given all the sorts of jobs, such as going into the copper after it had been used to boil up the brew to scrub it and prepare it for the next one, or into one of the fermenting vessels that had been used and scrub that. And that could be quite difficult, because sometimes the yeast had dried on the side. Now, the vessels were all copper-lined, so you had to get this dried yeast off the copper side, and sometimes it was quite a scrub. But again, it was physical and I enjoyed it. And it was just going around all the departments of the brewery, learning each part of it, what they did, what the difficulties were, and what you should be looking out for that might go wrong.
Was there a demand for excessive production in wartime of beer from the brewery?
I don't know what was being demanded, but we were working almost full out all the time. It wasn't a matter of saying, well, we've made a quota. We just kept making the beer and it still kept going around. Hello, my love.
So
it was interesting going around. But again, I was really poised, waiting to go off into the fleet era. So I enjoyed it. And then when I left, again, I think the brewery were very kind to me, because they did pay me a very small retainer all the time I was in the service during the war. So I felt obliged to go back to them after the war, although looking back on it, that was a mistake.
Did you enjoy your work there?
Yes. I've only once in my life been in a situation where I didn't enjoy my work. I've always enjoyed it.
Did you enjoy the beer, or...?
I wasn't a drinker then, really. I didn't really start drinking until I joined the Navy. No, I used to have to taste it sometimes, but I was being taught by the head brewer. And what he used to do was to lay out six glasses for each of the apprentices. And he'd say, right, I want you to taste it and write down a description of each one. And if you can tell me what it is, so much the better. And, of course, when we started off, we were hopeless at it. But I suppose after a while, we began to be able to pick out different... Actually, he was more interested in lagers, and we were tasting lagers. And I could always pick out Tennent's lager from Glasgow. I just knew that flavour immediately. And, of course, I knew our own lager. That was easy enough to pick up. But then he used to put in amongst it some German or Danish beers just to test us. And it was interesting, but that was the only drinking I did. So it wasn't until I became a naval aviator that I was led astray.
So what was the process of your call-up? What happened?
Well, I just got a letter from the Navy and a warrant to telling me to report to HMS Daedalus at Leon Solent on the 2nd of November 1942.
When you'd volunteered, had you had to have an interview?
Oh, yes. But it wasn't a very high-powered interview. It was, I think, if I remember rightly, the senior officer of the 10th Commander. And I was very lucky, actually, because one of the interviewing board was the pilot that flew me at Donnybristle. So when they asked me if I had had flying experience, I said, well, yes, I was lucky enough to fly with Lieutenant Machen. Oh. So that fell into place quite nicely. But then I was physically fit and keen to go, so it had been surprising if they hadn't taken me.
I was going to say, what were they actually looking for in the interview? Was there any things that you would have surmised they were looking for?
Oh, I don't know what they were looking for, but... looking back in later years, I think sometimes they were looking for the wrong thing. Because I think, latterly anyway, they were looking more for academic qualities rather than character qualities. Because there's no doubt that a fighter pilot and a ground attack pilot has to be aggressive to a certain extent. And in those days, more so, because when you were delivering a weapon, you had to get close enough to try not to miss. And the weapons themselves weren't all that hot. And if you were going to be certain of hitting, you had to be nearly delivering it in person. And this was particularly so when you were firing against a banner with live ammunition and that sort of thing. So there's no doubt they ought to, I think, have been looking more for particular characteristics for pilots for particular jobs. But it didn't seem to work out that way. And certainly later on in the Navy, they were looking for people with academic qualifications that would have taken them to degree level at university, which I suppose is nice to have an intelligent officer cadre, but it wasn't necessarily the right thing for pilots. Observers, again, in a different group, they really have to be quite mathematical and very conscientious and very trusting. But I don't remember them looking for anything in particular in my interview.
Not physical fitness or enjoyment of sport, was that?
Well, I think they asked me what I did, and I was very lucky in so much as when I was, one of the things I used to do was gymnastics, and I was at one time the junior gymnastic champion of Scotland. So when I said that, they knew I was reasonably physically fit anyway, and I wasn't colour blind, so they were content to have me.